Welcome to KABU, Cynthia Lou Coleman.
Good morning, Jen. How are you?
Good. And it's so delightful to have you on the show again. You're Professor Emerita of Communications at Portland State University and a researcher in the fields of scientific discourse, environmental policies, and their impacts on North American Indigenous peoples. Last month, you were on the show to talk about your recent book, Environmental Clashes on Native American Lands. So it's great to have you back on the program today to talk about Martin Scorsese's new film, Killers of the Flower Moon. Earlier this fall, Kaylee Simmons, Assistant Professor of Indigenous Nation Studies at Portland State University, join me to talk about Scorsese's new film, Killers of the Flower Moon. The film is based on the 2017 nonfiction book by David Gran and tells the story of the Osage tribe during an era when the discovery of oil on tribal lands in Oklahoma leads to wealth for Osage members and a series of tragedies, including horrific killings. Well, Cynthia Coleman, you are an enrolled member of the Osage Nation. So I appreciate your willingness to join me on the Omol to talk about the film from that perspective, as well as from your work as a scholar at the intersection of Indigenous and Western or settler colonial ways of knowing. Before talking about the film, would you want to say a bit more to introduce yourself?
Yes, thank you very much again, Dr. Hacken, for having me on. One of the things that the film has done is brought to light issues in Native America, not just the Reign of Terror. So I appreciate the opportunity to talk, and I would like to say I don't speak for other Osage people, and I don't speak for Native American people. It's only my own experience, so I wanted to make sure that people didn't misinterpret what I have to say. I was not born on the reservation, but my mother was, her mother was, and her mother was. So I feel like I am part of the tribe, even though I wasn't born there. And I've been taking advantage of the online language classes that they've had, courtesy of actually the pandemic. So they've sort of expanded their language classes, and I am happy to introduce myself to you in Osage. It's I would say to you, Have Ietoa Kipshe Kombre Mikshita Wita, Nirgonska, Wajaje, Cynthia Lou Coleman, Eshtatoto Apasoli. So what I said to you in my very poor Osage or Wajaje is that I'd like to tell you a few words in Osage, and my name is Cynthia Coleman, and my Lakota name is Ishtatoto, and I am from Gray Horse. So that sort of sets the stage. It also sets the stage a little bit for the film in the sense that the film is actually in the three villages of the Osage Nation, and it's set within a place we call Fairfax, which is cheek to jowl with Gray Horse, which is the name of the, shall I say, township where all this took place in the film. And so I would just say that it's accurate. It was filmed on location, and I got the impression reading through the Osage News and listening to the elders that the director was very respectful and that Indigenous people were involved, Osage people were involved at every step of the way in terms of the language, in terms of some of the actors and some of the crew as well. And the woman who helped with the costume design, we don't call them costumes, by the way, but that's what they call them in Hollywood, was really has gotten a lot of good press for making sure the design was correct. So I will say that that is the sort of the public feeling that is available if you get onto the Osage tribal website, very easy to find. They have glowing reviews of the film. And if you were to challenge that, I think the response is likely something like, well, it's just a movie.
Yeah. So you, I think the point here is you can overinvest, particularly in a film that's unique in portraying a politically repressed part of American history that is fraught in so many ways, and bringing it into consciousness through the medium of a very famous American film director who's also particularly known for gangster films, for his portrayals of rugged anti-heroes, and where the main characters are perhaps marginalized, but still at the center of kind of the American imaginary around, you know, the Western outlaw or gangster. And so this was a shift for him. And maybe we can talk about the gender politics of the film, which have, much like all of Scorsese's films, an air of critique, you know, that the female characters are often marginal to the main arc of the story, or just there to facilitate a passage in the hero, the anti-hero story. So how would you, would that be an okay place to begin?
Sure, we can talk about that and refer your audience members to your interview with Dr. Simmons in November, who is a historian of film, but also teaches film and, you know, can lend a different expertise. So it's a really good question to ask, what are the roles that the characters are playing in the film? It's different from the book. This is a film. It has a different arc in terms of telling a story. The word on the street is that Scorsese and the writers, and one of the writers is David Gran as well, but there are other writers involved. We're looking at this story through the lens of the white savior man who works for the FBI as coming in and saving the day. And what Scorsese said publicly in terms of news reports that I can get my hands on is that it changed when he came to Oklahoma to meet with the Osage people. He met with them long before the film was ever made to broker a good relationship with them. And he changed his mind. He said the arc of the story changed. And by that, I mean, it was not focused on Tom White, who is the name of the FBI director, who was sent in, and it sent in to solve these murders. So the backstory for people that haven't seen the film is that the film is about a series of murders that take place on the reservation in the 1920s, because the laws were written in such a way that the Osage people inherited the wealth from the oil that was discovered there. And this was something that is also part of the story that's really not told in the film. And that is that at the end of the day, the Osages were among the last that were relocated. And because David Gran writes that because they were among the last tribes, they have a bit more ability to negotiate with the federal government about the property that they ended up purchasing in Oklahoma. And in the book, Gran says that the chief at the time said, this is a desolate place. And so maybe we won't be bothered anymore by people coming in and wanting our land. But what they also did was they negotiated for the mineral rights. And that is how the Osage people were able to benefit from the discovery of oil. And this is rather new. So, of course, you skip forward to the time where they actually not only discover oil, but they're able to harness it. It's not something that you can
oil boom.
Exactly. You can't do anything with it unless you have the ability to extract that resource, right? So this is where a lot of people who are not Native got involved, right? You know, sort of, you know, building the oil wells, building the oil rigs, and they were offered leases by the Osage. So you see that in the film. You see people coming in to bid on the oil lease. And because the Osages would profit from that oil, to get back to sort of to circle back to your original question, is that they inherited what is called a head right to that oil. It remained in your family, but if you married somebody who was white. That's also part of your family. And there were some people that killed Osage men and women for that head right. And so that's really the centerpiece of the story in terms of solving these murders. Your question is, you know, what are the roles that are played? And, you know, one thing is that the attention was turned away from the FBI person. I mean, he was not the central character. The central character is a family, and the family includes a white gentleman and includes an Osage woman. And what is nice about the movie from the perspective of women being more important than just sort of ornaments to follow is that the character of Molly Burkhart is central to the story. And her husband, Ernest, is played by Leonardo DiCaprio. And so you can imagine that there is a lot of thought about who's DiCaprio going to be. He's a central person. Molly is played by Lily Gladstone, who is an actress, but I would say not an accomplished actress, nor in the same vein as DiCaprio. So there's a lot of talk on the street about the fact that she held the film together. Manolo Dargis, who was writing for the New York Times, said that she's the centerpiece of the story.
Yeah, she's the moral compass and offers a riveting performance, so much going on without even her speaking in various points. But she also could be viewed through the lens of a well-known Native character of the stoical moral presence of the Native who observes the horrors but abides in a spiritual realm above them. And she's for a long time through the film blind to her husband's violence and exploitive maneuvering of her and killing people in her own family. So is there a kind of dual place of woman as outside of men, of the evil doings of men, but kind of rising above them as a in a moral sphere that has been one trope, you know, for casting Native people as essentially spiritual and kind of outside the picture in a certain way. In the book, she seemed much more actively angry and reactive to what was happening around her than in the film, in my view.
I think that's also something that I've heard other people say. When we got out of the cinema, you know, one of the things that we were talking about is that relationship. And, you know, we were asking each other, well, do you think Molly knew? And, you know, what was going on? And I obviously can't answer that because that's all your own impression of what's going on. In terms of the stoicism, I do think that that is a trope that we see in a lot of Westerns. I also think there's a slightly different way of looking at it. And if I can give you a couple of examples, which I thought were not stoicism as much as part of an indigenous culture. So this is really, really hits home for me. And that is that she says to Ernest early when they meet, "You talk too much." And if you read some of the, not just the fiction, but the nonfiction books that are written by not just Osage people, but other Indigenous people as well, it's actually considered rude manners to talk a lot. And
I've learned that painfully as a talker.
And I think, you know, it's, you know, we can look at that as a kind of stoicism, but it's also like, you know, there are stories about people being silent and then, you know, somebody saying, why don't they say anything? And it's like, doesn't have anything to say. You know, not every space needs to be filled with conversation.
But this was a very profound tragedy unfolding for her. And I think the film did lead us to believe she was blind to it. And maybe that was an interesting theme in and of itself, her that there seemed to be some genuine love between her and her murderous husband,
white man.
And so that it kind of complicated some of that relationship as well, which of course is true in many lives of women who have abusive relationships with men. They can be complicated.
Right. And I think we as audience members want to see her, you know, either stick up for herself or, you know, sort of say something to Ernest or say something to somebody else about Ernest. And I think looking back at all these events that take place, beginning with Anna's death and then her mother's death, it just feels like it keeps adding on, right? So there's this death, you know, her child's death. And at the same time, she's being diminished because of the poisons that she's been given. Her mother was given poisons as well, according to David Gran. And I wonder if that is also the story, that it just is a pile of poop. And how do you find your way out of it?
The audience isn't offered this kind of resilient woman character who's expected to stand up to her abusive husband, but rather you see her undoing, although then she rises up at the end through the help of others. But yeah, and so there is a kind of expectation often on the part of in domestic violence stories and films that the woman rises up, and it doesn't take into account all of the ways that in the story, as an Osage person, she was under the toxic spell, very literally, of this husband who was killing her and slowly weakened in the process, diminished.
Right. And I think it also shows, at least for me, that Molly was a trusting person. You know, she was not a person who looked at somebody and said, how is this person going to screw me over? But rather, this, you know, taking him at his word. And recall at the end of the film, when they're having conversations, she says, is there something else that you're giving me? And he says, no. And she trusts him. I think that's important, important part of her character, not necessarily because she's Native, you know, but because she's a trusting individual.
And I think that does come through at the conclusion of the film, that the trauma and the toxic and lethal world that the Osage people have endured have not destroyed the spirit and capacities of Osage people. So there was an affirmation of that at the end of the film as well, that I think has been, I know Kayla Simmons emphasized that as well. You know, it's a lot of our analyses of films center on the denouement. You know, where does the film end? And who are the survivors? Who's left standing at the end? Well, I so much appreciate your coming onto the show today to talk, Cynthia Coleman, about Killers of the Flower Moon and bringing some of your own thoughts and insights to the film. And I think it's certainly worth seeing. And as you said, people are immediately talking about it as though the film is real. Like, okay, what's really happening? Well, it is a film's impression. Like the Osage Elder said, it's just a movie. But it's a pretty profound one because it takes up a sacred and important and forgotten part of American history, particularly for non-Native people.
Exactly. And I appreciate your comment, too, about the fact that it's just one moment in time, and that the Osages have not only survived, but we have also persevered. And Jean Dennison, who is a fellow Osage, wrote an editorial, if you have time to look at it, in Time magazine. It's the 19th of October when this film was released. And it's a very good piece that explains, look, the film is out, we get that, but let me tell you what we've done since that. And she talks about the fact that the Osages passed a resolution in 2006 that made it much easier to have its own governance. They bought up land from Ted Turner to expand our own reservation. We basically bought back our land. But, you know, they've reinvigorated the language programs, the health programs, and are thriving.
Yeah, as many Indigenous people have told me, we're still here.
Yes, right.
Here. Yes, okay, yeah. Thank you for being here today.
You're so welcome. Thank you for inviting me, Jean.
Yeah. And talking today with Dr. Cynthia Coleman about the film Killers of the Flower Moon. Take care.